My name is Daijaku Kinst, and I am the Hanyu Professor of Buddhist Chaplaincy at the Institute of Buddhist Studies at the Graduate Theological Union. So if you know the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, yeah, yay, yay, GTU, yay. Okay. I'm also the director of the Buddhist Chaplaincy Graduate Program there. So, and I am absolutely tickled pink to be here with two alums of our program. So this is a kind of old home week for us. We're going to be talking today about Buddhist principles of healing. So I'll be saying some words about cross-cultural research and discussing briefly the work of Professor Paula Arai, who I have to say I'm pleased is sitting in the front row with us today. So Professor Arai came here from Baton Rouge, where she is a professor of religious studies at Louisiana State University. So, then Reverend Joe Lawrence is going to be discussing the application of these principles in hospice chaplaincy. And then Alistair Shanks, who's here from Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, is going to be talking about Buddhist teachings and practices that support and underlie this very successful interfaith hospice volunteer training program. Okay, so you all are in the right place, kind of. Are we here now? Please make sure your cell phones are off. They send me this little blurb that tells you how to do the presentation, and they say, first thing, ask everybody to turn their cell phones off. So please do that. Okay. I'd like to begin with a moment of silence. So I found this handy little candy bowl here. And can I borrow your pen? Oh, my God. See what happens when you get Buddhists together? Somebody has a meditation. Unbelievable. Look at this. Look at this. Holy Moses. Okay, I'll see if I can do this. Okay, so please find a posture that you can breathe in and simply sit upright for a moment. Settle your minds and hearts. Bring your attention to our time together now. Take one final breath, and please end this time with a silent intention or prayer in support of our mutual care and learning. Thank you. Did you go one of them? Thank you, Laura. Thank you very much. No problem. So, in a sense, all chaplaincy work is cross-cultural research, right? Every family, every person, every group has its own culture. Bridging gaps is what chaplains do. Now, I have to say, I'm not a chaplain, which is pretty surprising, I think, to all of you. My master's was in counseling psychology, my PhD in Buddhism and psychology. So I brought that to supporting chaplains. So you'll forgive me if I'm not an expert on chaplaincy. But what I've seen when I did CPE and what I've seen in, as I engage with professionals and guide students, is that what chaplains do is bridge gaps. They look and listen and glean from what they see and hear ways to build bridges and bring appropriate and effective spiritual care to those they serve. So in a way, you all know quite a bit about this already. What I'm going to talk about today is a very particular kind of cross-cultural research and the benefit of bringing new perspectives to our understanding of pastoral care. In my role as professor and director of the Buddhist Chaplaincy Program, students and I study closely how do Buddhist teachings and practices guide us in providing spiritual care to everyone. So it's important, as you all know, to grapple with religious teachings in a general way in order to build a sound theological basis for one's ministry. All seminaries and training programs do this, right? But we also need to provide multiple ways of assessing and responding to and reflecting on specific pastoral care encounters within a framework that both is grounded in the tradition and is concrete enough to be meaningfully applied to these encounters. So I was considering this, sitting in my bed one night, thinking about how I was going to do this. And I realized that an excellent method of doing this was sitting on my bedstand. In my life as a Soto Zen priest, I had been eagerly awaiting and savoring the latest work of Professor Arai. The title of that book was Bringing Zen Home, The Healing Heart of Japanese Women's Rituals. It's a study of the religious and ritual lives of 12 contemporary Japanese Zen Buddhist lay women. So this book is a revelation, not only because of the meticulous nature of the ethnography at its base, but also because of its content. Professor Rai had developed a definition of healing and the 10 principles of healing expressed in the lived experience of the Zen Buddhist tradition. And I realized that it was directly applicable to pastoral care settings of all kinds. So first I'll go into a brief definition of healing and the principles, but what I'd like to do before that is speak briefly and reflect with you on the benefit of engaging in and studying cross-cultural research. So there's three aspects I want to consider with you. First, any well-done cross-cultural research, such as ARISE, is a model of attending to the environment in which the encounter takes place. Practicing self-awareness, engaging others with respect and openness, what Doring calls in the practice of pastoral care, radical respect for alterity. In addition, ARISE study demonstrates how we can listen to voices that have been unheard and challenge, and it challenges us to think, reflect, and consider a different view of the world. All of these qualities, attending to the environment, practicing self-awareness, openness and respect for the other, listening for what is unheard, and allowing ourselves to see things in new ways so that we might serve better, are essential to trustworthy and effective pastoral care. So Arai, in her study, brought her own experience, education and skills, as well as her commitment to mutuality, sensitivity, and respect to the study of healing. And we, reading her work, can learn something about how we can do the same thing. So this is one of the benefits of cross-cultural research. Second, the encounters between Arai and her consociates led directly to significant contributions to our understanding of healing and healing practices based in a Japanese Buddhist perspective. These contributions broaden our understanding and deepen our ability to care for others. They provide a strong, flexible basis for the work of Buddhist chaplains and a fresh and relevant perspective for non-Buddhists. Third, the process of translating these new perspectives and contributions into the world of interfaith chaplaincy bears fruit in several ways. First of all, it can reveal to us assumptions that we hold, what in Buddhism we call fixed views, that is, ways of seeing and responding that limit us. It can challenge us to broaden our perspective. Translation also requires us to be creative, to think about what we are doing and why, to find ways to use these and other teachings and perspectives in ways that both honor our own faith tradition and bring greater flexibility and richness to our pastoral responses. So picking up this book that was sitting on my bedstand and that I was enjoying and savoring as a Soto Zen priest challenged me to wonder what else was out there that I might be missing. What other perspectives was I not including? How could I reach out beyond my own boundaries, my own faith tradition, and explore possibilities I hadn't even considered? One of the most interesting outcomes of this cross-cultural interchange came when I presented a model of pastoral assessment and response based on Arai's research at an international symposium on practical ministry at Ryokuku University in Kyoto, Japan. Ryokuku, along with several other major universities in Japan, is developing a pastoral care curriculum and program. I felt a little bit like bringing coals to Newcastle, but the fact is, it opened up ways of viewing their own culture and religious tradition that they had not seen, and this led to further conversations. In a sense, it was coming full circle. Professor Arai, skilled in the ways of Japanese culture and language and interested in uncovering unseen wisdom about healing, had written in America about what she found when she studied the ritual lives and healing practices of Buddhist laywomen in Japan. Another professor, me, read the work and was inspired to do what I could to translate it to the field of pastoral care. I then took this model to Japan, where a professor in Japan who had been looking to America for inspiration, developing methods of pastoral care in Japan, learned about what was right in front of us all along. This, in turn, led to more discussions, enriching for all of us involved, as well as our students. This is an example of what can happen when we open our eyes to the potential of cross-cultural research. In my remaining time, I'd like to review briefly the definition of healing and the 10 principles. I think it's worth mentioning that the Buddhist tradition is often portrayed in popular culture in ways that bear little resemblance to the depth and breadth of the tradition itself. I know I'm going to say the R word here, religion. Many people do not consider Buddhism a religion, but in fact, for many of us, it is. It is often identified with secular mindfulness practices or seamlessly calm and serene, being seamlessly calm, or disengaged from day-to-day life. In fact, it is associated with all manner of things that are, for those of us that are Buddhist, kind of remotely or really absurd. So it's important to note that the work of Professor Arai is based not only in a deep knowledge of Japanese language and culture and Zen Buddhist teachings, but a deep experience and familiarity with Zen Buddhist practice. I will say, when you encounter this vision of healing and the 10 principles, you encounter Zen Buddhism in a very real sense. So healing, as defined in this model, is based on a Zen Buddhist vision of the world. It's a way of living that returns us again and again in each moment to the central fact of existence, according to this tradition, that we are woven into the fabric of being, that we are interrelationship. As Arai puts it, healing occurs when you have the bodily, heartfelt sense that you are integral to an all-encompassing network in which compassionate support is both given and received. Do you want to hear that again? Yeah. Healing occurs when you have the bodily, heartfelt sense that you are integral to an all-encompassing network in which compassionate support is both given and received. According to Mahayana Buddhist teachings, when we realize the fundamental truth that all beings and all aspects of reality, including ourselves, are completely interdependent, and that the delusion of essential separateness is just that, a delusion. When we realize interrelatedness, suffering is alleviated, and we are able to live lives of compassion, joy, and above all, gratitude. A return to the experience of interrelatedness is healing, and it occurs in the present moment, moment after moment. It is also available in all circumstances. So this is an orientation toward life marked by vigor, kindness, gratitude, and clarity. We don't have time to go into all of this today, but I want to mention, and I think this is important, especially in considering some of the other presentations that we've seen, that these principles can also serve as points of reflection for a chaplain as they craft a sustainable and vital life of service and self-care. So I encourage you to look at these principles and think about your own life. Each of them can also form the basis for what is generally termed theological reflection. So, healing. These principles articulate different ways of understanding healing. They emerged from the lives of women who had suffered, who struggled, who were real down-to-earth women. And we are benefiting from their wisdom. The first principle is experiencing interrelatedness. If we assume that the Buddhist teachings of interrelatedness and interdependence do indeed reflect the nature of the world in which we live, and that the experience of oneself as separate, alone, and isolated is a central element in suffering, then any movement toward a realization and experience of interrelatedness with oneself and all beings eases suffering. This is really simple. So, assessing the quality and nature of a person's connection to the world, humans, animals, inanimate objects, art, nature, spiritual beings, allows the chaplain to understand something of the nature and depth of a person's suffering or a group of people's suffering. With such an understanding and assessment, interventions can be considered that support the development of a deeper sense of connection. This could be as simple as listening to stories about a person long gone, facilitating contact with someone who is central to that person's relational world, praying with a person to invoke a holy presence, meditating, chanting, anything you can think of. The second principle is living body-mind. In Japanese Buddhism, a person is considered to be an indivisible unit. Mind and body are not separate. From this perspective, considering the needs of the body are important. The body is not a vehicle for the mind or the self. It is an integral part of the subjective experience. It is essential. So this view supports a non-adversarial relationship to illness or physical difficulties. In terms of assessment intervention, the chaplain could, for example, attend to the ways in which changes in physical ability evoke a sense of alienation of the body and mind. Interventions could be based on reducing that alienation and increasing an effective response to the situation as it exists. When I wrote this originally, I was thinking of the Boston bombing and how a woman who had lost her leg earlier in her life came to the hospital and demonstrated for people an integral sense of being a human being who has lost a leg. In other words, she had healed this split and could help other people heal this split. The third is engaging in rituals. Rituals in this context are activities that enact a person's deepest values and relationship to their life and world. They affirm the importance and relevance of these values and the person who holds them. Rituals can have an impact across time and can knit together physical, emotional, relational, and spiritual aspects of a circumstance. And they do this with or without cognitive understanding of how they function. For example, planting a living thing in the earth, washing one's hands, washing one's feet, or having someone else wash one's feet, lighting a candle, not in a hospital, obviously, saying a prayer, chanting or bowing, all of these are rituals, and they can be quite ordinary activities, and they are not necessarily tied to a religious tradition. I think we all know this. The fourth is nurturing the self. So, attending to the needs of the self reflects an understanding that your life and yourself matter. Taking even small steps for the to care for the self can build a sense of being of value. Experience a sense of inner value supports actions that care for the self. It goes in both directions, right? So the Buddhist teaching of interrelatedness points to a view in which ultimately we are not different from the universe itself. Therefore, caring for the self is caring for the universe and all beings. This is not an understanding of self-care rooted in a self-centered vision of the world and one's place in it, quite the opposite. It is a vision that supports a sense of proportion and responsibility. This can be particularly helpful for people who really are absent a sense of caring for the self. Assessing the ability of an individual to effectively care for themselves allows the chaplain to respond effectively. It brings awareness to a level of responsibility a person feels for his or her own well-being and how they can how they relate to self-care. Enjoying life is a fifth principle. In this context, enjoying life does not mean turning away from the circumstances with an eye towards denial. It emerges from a recognition of what the Buddhists frame as impermanence. You might have heard of this in Buddhist teachings. And a curiosity about what true enjoyment is. The focus is cultivating a relationship with one's life in which joy and appreciation can coexist with difficult circumstance, and as we know, this can be deeply challenging. In the face of great loss, a person's capacity for joy can be erased for a time. However, if a chaplain is going to assess accurately the spiritual needs of a person, it is a dimension that must be included. The sixth principle is healing, is creating beauty. Beauty heals, and keeping an eye out for moments that invite it can transform a situation. A person's sense that they have the capacity to create beauty can also empower them. Beauty can be experienced in very small things. Assessing the quality of an experience, of a circumstance, and thinking in terms of creating beauty allows the chaplain to respond to needs that may not be addressed by any others on the caregiving team. Again, if we remember that the self is interrelated with all aspects of a circumstance, attending to the inner and outer quality of beauty can lead to healing. The seventh principle, cultivating gratitude. Gratitude from the perspective of these Buddhist teachings is central. It arises naturally when we consider that the interdependent nature of reality. Each breath and all else are given to us every moment by all beings. Assessing for the presence or capacity for genuine gratitude can give the chaplain a good indication of a person's needs and resources for recovery and healing. To be able to say thank you in the midst of difficulty is perhaps, I think, the defining characteristic of spiritual maturity. Any interventions that can be and must be handled with sensitivity and care in this circumstance. And according to this model, a life guided by gratitude is a life of healing. Eight is accepting reality as it is. Facing what is called in Buddhism the first noble truth, that is that suffering exists, is difficult. And it must be accompanied by the other three noble truths, which means there's a path, right? We have our own path. You can pick your path. But the fact is, facing reality as it is and having a path out of suffering are essential to healing. Facing this difficulty of suffering in full flower can be an occasion for disintegration or transformation. I think we all know this. being willing to move toward accepting life as it is, not as we would like it to be or as we think it should be, creates the conditions for healing. The women in this study are very clear about this. Rejecting one's situation is draining and diminishes respect for oneself and one's life. While acknowledging the importance of respecting the time that is needed for adjusting to a new circumstance, assessing for and responding to lack of acceptance gently and respectfully supports this mode of healing. 9 is expanding perspective. Cultivating the capacity for an expanded perspective on one's life, oneself, and one's circumstance empowers a person in their healing. Particularly expanding our perspective grounded in an ability to interpret meaning and significance events according to a person's deepest values. Assessing for a person's capacity to shift and expand their perspective, to see things in a new way according to their deepest values, allows us to help them support and shift towards a mode of healing. This shift can unfold long after the pastoral care encounter ends. This shift can support deepening of healing over many, many years. The 10th and final principle is embodying compassion. In this Buddhist model, the root of healing and its fruit is the capacity to embody compassion. Without compassion, the ability to be oneself in the presence of suffering with care and kindness, in other words, with the elements that support genuine healing, is difficult. Attending to the degree and quality of kindness and compassion present in any given situation allows the chaplain to intervene with some sense of what will be most appropriate and most effective. If a chaplain embodies a vigorous, honest, and I would add unsentimental compassion, this can be the most effective intervention of all. And I would say not just to the people that you're serving, but towards yourself. So I hope you will all reflect on this definition of healing and these 10 principles and discover how it might support you to see things in a fresh way and to develop your own sense of resilience, your path of practice, and your service to others. Thank you. So now Joe is going to talk about how these take place in hospice.
Hear me? Okay. So I want to start by saying how glad I am that you're all here. I feel like we have really incredible jobs with profound responsibility, and I feel like we're in these positions and situations where we're really triaging. We're triaging real life on a day-to-day basis, no matter what kind of chaplaincy you're doing. And so to extend our sort of dots that we can connect and open our minds to provide new ideas and new contexts that we might deepen our own theological understanding. But also, for me, the Buddha Dharma is very about pragmatism. It's very pragmatic. And so, Reverend Daijaku did such a great job of just really explaining that these 10 healing principles aren't patriotic to Soto Zen. You know, it's not about taking them out of their absolutely stunning cultural and religious context, but really showing that they are available to be used in the way that's sincere and authentic to you and your work, so that you can be in integrity in your philosophy, your theology, which you're doing all the time, right? This is what we do as chaplains. Most of us are traversing interfaith, non-faith, all the time. But just to really, really make that clear. So I work as a palliative care and hospice chaplain in Portland. And I discovered these healing principles thanks to Reverend Daijaku. I was in Buddhist seminary, and I was working as a chaplain at the same time. And I had begun an inquiry into healing years before, and it had started to become more and more articulated, working with incarcerated people, doing lots of different kinds of work in my ministry, and then finding myself in the trenches of death and dying. Really put this question of healing and the meaning of healing, and also simultaneously the meaning of wholeness in my face. My cutting of my teeth was on a surgical oncology unit in San Francisco, and the unit is sort of the hospital's pretty famous, at least in California, for worst case scenarios end up there. So I have no doubt that you guys know exactly what I mean and have probably spent some time in environments like this. So we were inaugurating this palliative team on an oncology unit that should have had a palliative team years ago. You understand. But it hadn't. So here we were, finding our way. And it became so clear that another piece that Daijaku mentioned is really this internal, external process that's happening all the time around. We're facing these intense situations and we're meeting them externally, but we're also meeting them internally. So we have to do a lot of shakedowns around, can I face this? Because if we're really going to stand next to somebody who's just been given a pretty heinous prognosis perhaps, we need to be ready to stand with them and to cultivate bravery and a level of presence and availability to witness what they're going through, so that sort of experience of interrelatedness, which I feel like is such a fundamental piece of what we do as chaplains, literally sometimes physically showing up, is an experience of interrelatedness for someone who is completely out of their element, whether they are in the SHU, solitary confinement, in a federal prison, or they are in a hospital which bears no resemblance to anything familiar or comfortable. And I wanted to share, to sort of really explicate, just kind of give an example of how applicable these healing principles are. I wanted to share with you a brief story of a young woman who I met on the surgical oncology unit who, for me, pushed me out of my comfort zone in a good way around really holding that healing is dynamically occurring all the time. And wholeness is dynamically true all the time, even when life gets crazy, uncomfortable, terrifying, and unfamiliar, and the bottom drops out. And I met this young woman, Helen. She was 31 years old. And the day I met her was the day after she had come out of a surgical procedure. She had a rare vaginal cancer, very rare. And when I met her, she was literally a sea of staples. And we're all tough here. We can handle this, I think. Staples and wounds. And she was beautiful, smart, sensitive, bless you, had a profound relationship with nature. That was her spirituality, was being in nature and gardening and being in the earth and being with her dog. And she was completely out of her element and she was unraveling fast. And I don't blame her a bit, because I imagine if I were in her position today, tomorrow, I might do a lot of that too. So I showed up. Of course, I really didn't know much about her. And we sort of initiated what would become a 9-month relationship. So palliative care team was involved. The gynecological oncology team were the primary sort of leading team, but we were consulting all the time about symptom management because she was not managed symptomatically, her pain. And really, most of all, her terror was not managed, right? Okay, we're going to do the surgery, and then you're going to kind of figure it out. Well, it's really a lot to ask of somebody. So we embarked, like I said, on this relationship, and we started to sort of go more deeply, and I was learning more about her relationship with her familial context and thinking of experiencing interrelatedness just to sort of sow this seed. I feel like each of the principles is so multi-layered also, and all of them are actually interrelated. So it's really hard to parse, as Americans say, parse out them as sort of unique entities. Whenever I say pass, nobody understands what I'm saying. And so I feel like it's just important to acknowledge that they're all, you start pulling one apart and you find all 10 in them. But with experiencing interrelatedness, I've really learned that I feel like there are at least two major aspects here. And as chaplains, you'll totally get what I'm saying, I hope. One is a sort of conventional earthly realm-based experience of interrelatedness, family, community, societal recognition, physical comfort. And the other is sort of an existential, right, experience of interrelatedness. And perhaps some folks we work with are really trying to sort of cultivate a narrative around what is my relationship to my bigger panoramic view. And some are trying to figure out, why can't I get along with my mom? You know, or why do I feel so disconnected from my family of origin? And in Helen's case, it was earthly, very earthly. She was so spiritual in the ways she was so grounded in her existential context. But her family life hadn't really been good to her. And she was very lonely. And her mother, I met her many times, and I don't think I was entirely projecting that she was quite cold, because Helen particularly mentioned this a number of times. And would say things like, you know, come on, you gotta like get it together, and that wasn't really effective in this context. So what I started to see was that exactly. Really, did you say whatever?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. So what I started to see in the months that I related to Helen, she would come and go from the hospital. She started radiation once her wounds started to heal, which they never really did. And she started to become very familially, like family, community-wise, comfortable on our unit. And the nurses and the social workers and the case managers were basically all about her age. Mostly women, it happens a lot, right, in these service professions, serving the professions. And she was so much more at home with us than when she would be discharged home. And she would be so alone. And she would come back because her pain would crisis. And so I started just even allowing the possibility that there was some healing happening here. And I really checked myself because I thought, am I doing like a spiritual bypass? I'm trying to make what's happening to Helen okay. And I realized, I don't think so. I think this is like real, you know? And she was so loved up, and she got to do art, creating beauty. She got to do art, very creative, artistic young woman. And I would see her come to life. So this was profound for me, because I really started to allow myself to trust the instinctual relationship with healing that had been developing. And then it became clear, the plot thickens, of course, that she was not going to survive her diagnosis. And the cancer was aggressive, and it was spreading, and she wasn't healing. And there was so much triaging that needed to be done. I was the only palliative chaplain on the unit, and I was triaging Helen's reality, but in a way more, I was triaging those caring for her. And it was actually, though, quite a gorgeous, consuming activity for me. It was very participatory. We were really engaged in real relationships. And so finally, Helen took me aside one day in her weak moment, like a physically weak and tired, and said, Joe, I want to ask you if you'll do something for me. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? Well, I would like if we could have a care conference. And if you'll tell my oncologist, who is incredibly smart and incredibly devout and actually a little bit of a bully, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is the care plan. We are going to do this, when actually she's going to do this, right? Helen is going to be doing this. Can you bring my mom and the oncologist together and tell them that I want to be allowed to go to hospice and die? I'm tired. I don't want to keep doing this. And they won't listen to me. I was like, I've got your back. So we got together. I let the oncologist start, because that feels like the sort of appropriate hierarchy in those situations. And so she was going on, and this is going to get better, and this. And I finally said, well, it doesn't seem like that's actually what's happening anymore. And I really want to thank you for your dedication to Helen, and she really wants to thank you. And she has asked me to tell you guys, both of you, Mom, that she actually wants to be discharged to an inpatient hospice nearby. She wants to die. And you could hear a pin drop for a minute. And, you know, chaplains, I think, oftentimes, we really are the ones who have to name the elephant in the room, say the really awkward stuff. So it was effective. Helen was discharged to an incredible hospice where she lived for about a week, 4 days or so. She was unconscious with her beloved dog at her side. And I took Helen's life ending that way as legitimate validation for this healing. And I saw that so much happened for her that I'm not sure I'm not God. I'm not trying to say I'm the divine consciousness who knows everything, has the ultimate panoramic view. But it did cross my mind that perhaps something happened for her that might not have happened otherwise. It's a koan. It's a contemplation. I wonder. And it was after I met Helen that I met these healing principles that really then have gifted me the ability to articulate why and how I approach the work I do. And currently I'm in the field. I've been for years driving around to different people's houses and facilities, working in both the palliative and the hospice realm. Pretty distinct nuances, I'm sure you guys all know. Like, hospice is one thing, palliative is another, and there's a lot of streams that go between, and there's a necessary distinction. Hospice is kind of frightens people, right? And soon the word palliative care will do the same, because this is how we are. We live in a death-averse culture, and as His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, in the West you think that dying is an option. And I find that so helpful, because I always remember this as a mantra, that this is a thick layer that's present in every situation that I'm in. So, speaking of the 10 principles, and I'm almost wrapping up here, embodying compassion is huge here, right? Because we tread so gently in this known sort of death-denying culture. And we know that we have to be so kind. And that even what I loved that I learned from being on an oncology unit, because I did get to the point for a while where I thought, I am going to lose my hair because I am so mad at these oncologists. And then I realized, oh my gosh, like, bless, you know, this is their training. And death is a failure. And, you know, that's a lot to live with. And once I started to observe the oncologists, I started to see this level of devastation in them when somebody died. And I'm still in hospice, and it's not all this. It's not every oncologist is the same. There are some who are just very direct, very clear boundaries. So I just want to take that back a little bit. But usually when I meet oncology patients now in hospice, they are days away from death. So we're kind of working in this realm. It's very complicated, right? And there's lots more to say. So I feel like I'm kind of relatively at my time here, and I want to thank you all so much for listening. And just to say that, just throw caution to the wind and allow even, you know, we sow seeds, or seeds get thrown at us, right? And maybe a week later or a year later or so, we think, oh my gosh, like, I wonder about that living body mind, or creating beauty, or accepting reality as it is, which I feel like is so huge in the work that we all do. And how do we do that in the loving, present, sensitive, empathic sort of ways that we all do our work? So I'm really looking forward to the end when perhaps we can have some lovely Q&A, and I trust that this room is full of vibrant experience and profound intelligence and vastly different theological sort of understandings and philosophical understandings. So I look forward to that. Thank you all.
Well, good morning. Thank you for coming. I'm going to speak about the Zen Hospice Project model of care. So I've been a volunteer at Zen Hospice Project. I was a volunteer for 10 years, starting in 2004. And I took a couple of years off to go to school, and now I'm the volunteer program manager there. So for 30 years, Zen Hospice Project has been providing end-of-life care based on Buddhist principles to a primarily non-Buddhist population. It provides volunteers both in an institutional setting at a 60-bed hospice and palliative care unit in a county hospital, and in a residential setting at the 6-bed Zen Hospice Project guest house. So what I like to do is look at how it's done this by examining three key components of our model of care and of the volunteer training program. The training program is based on a transformational model rather than an informational one. So it's based on the simple assumption that it's only through an honest examination of our own relationship to loss and to grief that we can be fully present with the grief and the suffering of others. In this case, it's not so much about teaching skills as it is about helping people transform their relationship to death. In doing this, what we discover is that the caregiver gets as much out of the relationship as the person receiving the care. And at Zen Hospice Project, we often refer to this as mutuality of service. It's a reciprocity in the relationship between the caregiver and the care receiver. UCLA psychologist Shelley Taylor has coined the phrase tend and befriend. Some of you may have heard of this. And it's basically refers to the phenomenon that personal suffering can lead people to the desire to alleviate the suffering of others. And a recent study of 150 middle-aged people found that in sharing the stories of their lives, there was a common theme among the happiest participants, that the personal suffering inspired them to do something to help the suffering of others. They transformed their suffering from a negative into a positive. And speaking for myself personally, that's how I came to hospice, is that I came to hospice many years ago at a time of great personal suffering in my own life. So what I would like to focus on are three principles of the Zen Hospice model of care. And those principles are mindfulness, interdependence, which both Reverend Daijaku and Reverend Joe have spoken about a little bit already, and community, or the idea of sangha. So let's look at mindfulness first. I'm going to quote this. This is a favorite quote of mine by a woman named Simone Weil. She says, "Attention is the purest and rarest form of generosity." And I like to think about mindfulness that way. It's just a simple attention, a specific kind of attention to people. And so I want to look at the what, the why, and the how of mindfulness, what it is, what its function is, how we use it, and why we do it. And it's helpful to put it into context by considering it in a popular perspective and in a theological perspective, and then from the Zen Hospice perspective. So mindfulness from a popular perspective is it's usually presented as a self-help technique, a way to achieve happiness. It's also embraced as a corporate productivity tool to make people more productive and happier in their jobs. Google does this. And at Zen Hospice Project, we use it specifically to apply it to end-of-life care. excuse me. In a theological sense, I'm going to focus primarily on the practical, but I want to put it into context by saying that, that mindfulness is a foundational component of Buddhist theology. And it occupies an essential place in the Buddhist teachings and canon, and especially in two particular very important sutras in Buddhism teachings. But the principle of mindfulness is that it's not a theological belief. It's not inherently religious. At Zen Hospice Project, mindfulness is really foundational to the way in which we apply end-of-life care. And you can think of it as attentive openness, a non-judgmental awareness, a way to bring us into contact with ourselves, remembering to bring the mind into the present moment. So that's what the practice of mindfulness does for us. And it's a moment-to-moment awareness of the suffering that we meet at the bedside, as well as a moment-to-moment awareness of our reactions to that suffering, to our own emotional responses. At Zen Hospice Project, we apply it in two different ways. We use it in meditation, and obviously we use it in service. So we cultivate mindfulness and meditation so that we can develop the habit of applying mindfulness in the more difficult framework of meeting suffering at the bedside, of meeting people who are dying and really suffering. The way we use it in the meditation for the volunteers is that volunteers will do a 10-minute period of sitting both before and after their shift, during their shift change meeting. And then I'll say more about the shift change meeting in a moment. And in sitting in meditation, it gives us the opportunity to check in with ourselves. What am I feeling? What emotions are coming up? What thoughts? Am I restless? Am I agitated? So checking in with the three centers of the head, the heart, and the body. In service, mindfulness is about the awareness of the self and the other. And this is very critical because we want to be aware both of our inner and our outer reality. One way of thinking about this is that nothing is left out. Mindfulness embraces everything. It's not just about being mindful and being happy, trying to create some state. It's about being fully present with whatever is actually occurring in the moment. So why do we use mindfulness in end-of-life care? I think, as everybody knows, that in meeting suffering and sitting with the dying, is that inevitably what we discover is our own edges, is our own areas of discomfort. And so I think of especially the practice of meditation and applying mindfulness in meditation as learning to be comfortable with discomfort. And so when we are sitting at the bedside, being comfortable with the suffering that we meet and our uncomfortable reaction to that suffering, that is a practice all in itself. It gives us insight into ourselves, our own places of wounding, loss, and heartbreak. And it's through our own experience of suffering that we're best able to fully connect to the suffering of another. I'd like to share a story with you about a young woman who came into hospice a number of years ago. She was Chinese, and she was when I sat down to introduce myself and spend some time with her, it was clear that she was in a great deal of distress, not just physical pain, but existential pain too. And she didn't speak very much English, and there was really nothing that I could do. I mean, I felt helpless. And what I realized in that moment is that she was powerless, I was helpless, and my role in that moment was not to do anything. I felt the need, I felt compelled to want to do something to alleviate her suffering, but there was nothing I could do. And so all I could do was to be with her. And I was aware in that moment, I was aware of my own suffering, of my own helplessness, that we were just two beings sitting in this impossible situation with nothing to do. And as I relaxed into that realization, what came up for me was just this feeling of love, this immense love for this poor, suffering woman. And that's when I began to understand just the simple power of presence, of being with someone. I'd like to turn now to the idea of the teaching of interdependence. And I want to start by reading a quote from the 8th century monk Shantideva. And he says that everything we do affects the world. Any action can be the cause or the cause of the cause of another's suffering. So interdependence is another core concept in Buddhist theology. And it's, in the simplest terms, it's just the recognition that all beings are interdependent. We all depend on one another in this web of life. And interdependence can't be separated from the expression of compassion, because if we see ourselves as mutually dependent, then we're naturally, instinctively going to act for the benefit of others. And you can't also separate this idea of interdependence from the idea of causes and conditions, that everything that we encounter in the material world, everything in our experience, is a result of something that caused that to arise. And the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh has coined the phrase interbeing to refer to this idea of interdependence. So I'm going to read a quote from him. He says, "If you are a poet, you will see clearly that there is a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow, and without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. If we look into the sheet of paper even more deeply, we can see the sunshine in it. If the sunshine is not there, the forest cannot grow. In fact, nothing can grow. Even we cannot grow without sunshine. And so we know the sunshine is also in this sheet of paper. The paper and the sunshine inter are. And if we continue to look, we can see the logger who cut the tree and brought it to the mill to be transformed into paper. To be is to interbe. You cannot just be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with every other thing. When we want to understand something, we cannot just stand outside and observe it. We have to enter deeply into it and be one with it in order to really understand. If we want to understand a person, we have to feel their feelings, suffer their sufferings, and enjoy their joy." So at Zen Hospice Project, the idea of interdependence is usually expressed in this phrase that service is mutually beneficial. And this is a core belief at Zen Hospice Project, that service is meant to benefit the caregiver as much as the person receiving the care. The idea of a helper-helpee relationship is inherently unequal. We do not see the other person who's ill as less than or flawed or broken in some way, someone that needs to be fixed. So the San Francisco physician and author, Rachel Naomi Remen, she says that serving is different than helping. Helping is not a relationship between equals. A helper may see others as weaker than they are, needier than they are, and people often feel this inequality. The danger in helping is that we may inadvertently take away from people more than we could ever give them. We may diminish their self-esteem, their sense of worth, integrity, or even wholeness. So the way that this can work in hospice is that we form relationships. And there is a notion that I hope now is really pretty outdated, this notion of professional warmth, of detachment, that you have a bedside manner, but you keep yourself at arm's length from the person you serve. And, excuse me, I really feel that, I tell our volunteers this all the time, that what we do is about relationships. We form relationships with people, we become close to people, and we grieve their loss. Even if we've only known them for a few days, or sometimes in certain cases, months and months. And I thought about the story of a woman that I met in hospice a number of years ago named Dee Dee. And she was a middle-aged African-American woman. And I didn't really have much in common with her. And for whatever reason that, you know, is really still a mystery to me, we just really hit it off. We really liked one another, and I spent a lot of time with her. And when she died, my supervisor asked me, he said, "What have you learned about love?" And I said, I thought about it, and it took me aback at first, and then I realized that my notion of love had always been conditional. I loved somebody because. There was always a because. And what I realized with Dee Dee is that there was no because. My love arose for her out of something else. So I think that we serve from the knowledge that we also need help. We did in the past, and we will in the future. The next thing I like to turn to is community or sangha. And the notion of community is so important in Buddhism that it's one of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the three jewels of Buddhism is the Buddha himself, the teaching of the Buddha, the Dharma, and this notion of community, a community of practitioners. And we at Zen Hospice Project, we often say we don't do this work alone. So I want to look at two things here. I want to look at the grief ritual that we perform in our new volunteer training, and I want to look at the shift change meeting that volunteers engage in every day that they perform their shift. So the grief ritual is done within the framework of our new volunteer training, and this is a 40-hour training, initial training. And the participants are asked over a silent lunch to write a letter to someone that they've lost. And they can express whatever they want in this letter, feelings of longing, unresolved issues. Lots of stuff may come up, as you can imagine. And in the afternoon session, we gather together in a circle, and each person comes up one by one to the front of the room and reads aloud their letter. And as you can imagine, these are very personal documents. And it's a very emotionally charged exercise. After they read their letter, they ring a bell and they sit down and the next person comes up. So this is this process of witnessing and being witnessed, engaged in communally. And I think there are three important elements that occur within this. The first is reflection, that people need to initially reflect on their story. What it is that they want to say to this person, how they want to frame it. In order to tell a story, they have to discover the structure of the story and in that the meaning of it. And you also, in order to write the story, you have to organize your thoughts into a coherent whole, into a narrative, a lucid narrative. And in that way, meaning may become apparent. The next part of this is disclosure. Is that in getting up in front of the group, people are exposing themselves. They're becoming vulnerable to these places of pain within themselves. In the process, they're able to give some of the weight of that pain to the people that are witnessing them. And trust and courage are developed at the same time. The sharing of the stories brings them to life. And shared stories need to be heard. They need to be witnessed. And this is especially true at the end of life. And people who are dying often have a need to share about their lives and about who they are. And so this is the role of community, and the way, one way in which we apply it as Zen Hospice Project is to hold one another and to witness one another's pain and struggle. The grief ritual instigates an active process of reflection, adaptation, and integration of the suffering narrative. The ability to articulate detailed and thoughtful accounts of loss and struggle in their own lives is a critical skill for the hospice volunteer as they are asked to sit with the loss and the struggle of others. And so finally, I want to look at the shift change meeting. And the shift change meeting is something that occurs at the beginning and the end of every volunteer shift. People meet for an hour, the volunteers meet for an hour, they sit for 10 minutes in meditation, and each person in the group speaks in turn while the others witness them. And this is a peer support model and also an action reflection model. People get a chance to share information about the patients, about the residents they serve, and also to support one another. So it's a liminal space to reflect and digest. And the idea, I also want to add that the idea of community embraces not just the residents, not just the family members, but it embraces the volunteers and the staff members too. So I encourage our volunteers to be available for the staff. Oftentimes, the CNAs at any hospital are often the hardest working people there, and they're also the closest to the patients. They're the ones that form real deep bonds with the patients. And I have found on multiple occasions that making myself available to the CNAs has been immensely beneficial to both them and myself. That it's they are included in our circle of care. So to conclude, I would just like to reiterate that the Zen Hospice Project model relies, these are just three of the things that Zen Hospice Project relies on, the idea of mindfulness, the idea of interdependence, and the idea of community. And this notion that we don't do it alone. And by doing it in community, this helps us build resilience, and it avoids the risk of compassion fatigue and of burnout. So I'd like to end just by reading a brief quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. "You are me, and I am you. Isn't it obvious that we inter are? You cultivate the flower in yourself so that I will be beautiful. I transform the garbage in myself so that you will not have to suffer. I support you, you support me. I am in this world to offer you peace. You are in this world to offer me joy." Thank you.
So thank you both very much. Thank you. I'm sure there are many questions and comments, and so I'd like to open the floor to that. We have, I think we're supposed to end at 11:45. Yeah, so we have about 15, 20 minutes for questions. So please, for any of us, please feel free to perhaps stand and say your question, or I can bring the mic to you, and I welcome them. Yes.
Are really striking, and so I appreciate that cross-cultural dimension very much. The question that I have is probably unanswerable, but in looking at the principles, one sort of hidden and almost shameful question that I live with as a chaplain is that I'm not sure when what we can do medically to help people becomes a harmful thing, not just to a person who's being overtreated like Helen, but also to our environment, to our society, to our culture, because we are living out this notion that that dying is an option. And so in looking at the principles of having to accept things the way they are, I was just wondering if you could comment on when does medical intervention start harming our enjoyment of life, our respect for the rest of the world, etc.
I just have a quick response to that, and I think that is such a beautiful question. I think we'd all agree that's like right getting to the heart of our world right now. And so I would say let's all keep that question very close.
I might just add one thing. That's a really great question, and I think it's a constant conversation, right? Because if we're looking at skillful response, we're also wondering what the person needs in terms of living out their death, right? And so for some folks, I get out of the way because all of them, but in this particular way of... I want to say, please don't do any more experimental chemos. And I offer it up in prayer. And sometimes they need to do that until there's nothing left physically. And I just, actually, we lost a close family friend, my wife's best friend. She was 55 and just died 6 weeks ago of stage 4 cancer. Now, for her, her way of doing things was like, pursuit. And I really stayed out of any conversations that she and my wife would have about treatments. And it wasn't until she hit a significant rock bottom that I finally, she's in Los Angeles, said, can I set you up with a palliative care consult? But with humility and spaciousness, if the answer was no. But I felt a calling from her asking for that. And it happened. Well, she ultimately, it was profound, the interaction they had, the doctor and she. Well, she ultimately did die from a last experimental chemo that pushed her into liver failure. But I learned so much from watching her because it was her life, right? So it's all about this conversation, I think, of, and then I'll end it because I don't want to go on too long, but informed consent, which I think is can feel like a bit of a moral injury piece because we're watching people that often aren't really informed of what's going to happen to their bodies when they ingest whatever it is. And so I try to, I guess for me, do what I can around that and then let it go and offer it up in prayer. But it is very wounding to watch. So does that give you any? Okay. But I've learned to consider it that it actually might be the right thing for that person in that stage of their evolution.
Other questions? Yes.
We have two rituals that we use at the Zen Hospice Project guest house when somebody dies, and we offer this to family members, and sometimes they refuse, and sometimes they accept. The first one is a kind of anointing or ritual washing. And we used to do it, do the whole body. Typically now what we'll do is we'll just do the hands, the feet, and the face. And we make a mixture, an herbal mixture. It's called Yerba Santa, which is actually pennyroyal. But it was used by the Indians in San Francisco a long time ago for medicinal purposes. And so we'll make an herbal mixture, and we'll pour it into a bowl, and we'll remove any kind of medical paraphernalia from the room, set up candles, drape things with gold cloths, and have this bowl and some washcloths. And it's really powerful. The family, sometimes family members are at a loss of what to do when someone dies. And I think that giving them the opportunity to somatically interact with their loved one, to touch them, the permission to touch, can be really, really significant. And it can be so powerful for everybody involved to just very gently each person take a turn with the washcloth, you know, getting it wet in the bowl, squeezing it out, and gently, lovingly washing the hands, the feet, and the face. The other ritual that we offer is that once the person is taken downstairs by the mortuary, is we'll stop on the back deck and we'll open the bag and expose the person's face. And flower petals are gathered from around the house before this. And we sprinkle flower petals, and everybody gets a chance to say a last goodbye. And I personally think I've learned to really appreciate ritual. And I think that one of the powerful things about ritual is that we engage in it physically. We use our bodies. It's a somatic practice. And I think that that is really significant. You kind of pointed to this with your question. So that's what I can say, two things that we do at Zen Hospice Project. You're welcome.
Facilitating that, because it's so important, you know, to find meaning even in that. Like, what am I passing on? And I also sometimes worry about intention of making that burden on the person.
Yes.
You know, sort of, you find the wisdom that you're going to give me in this moment. Mm. And so, you know, I was wondering, you know, to pull this group and to pull you to think about how to do that in a caring fashion that takes burden away, but in, you know, sort of increases the reciprocity of that relationship. That, you know, again, it's not, you know, me to you, but it's us to each other. You know, I was wondering your thoughts, you know, in the ministry.
One of the things that I would say is to go back to this idea of relationship, is that it's really relational. And when we form a friendship or a relationship with someone, there's this process of disclosure, of exposure. Like, you tell me something and I tell you something. And I think that that's really where reciprocity has to come from, is that mutual exchange. Is not any expectation of an outcome in any particular way. I don't know if this is helpful, but I'll share a story about a friend of mine who had a terminal lung condition. It was going to kill him unless he got a double lung transplant. And I started visiting him weekly, and he was housebound and tethered to a long oxygen tube and really wrestling with a lot of existential issues and even doubtful whether he wanted to go through a double lung transplant because it's such a huge and serious operation and has actually a relatively poor success rate. And, you know, this was a colleague of mine. He had been a volunteer at Zen Hospice Project, and I hadn't been close to him before then, but I became very close to him at that time. But after visiting him for a while, he asked me this question that just about broke my heart. He said, would you have become my friend if I hadn't become sick? And what he was really saying was, do you value me? Is this, you know, am I giving you something? That's what he was saying. Are you getting something from me? And it was just, at that moment, I realized how important it is for people who are ill to not feel that you're coming up to them, oh, I'm here to help you. They want to be related to as an equal, just as we were speaking about. And so I don't know if that's helpful, but...
Another example, just quickly. Okay, just really quickly. I'm currently working with a 60-year-old woman who's dying, actually in transitional mode right now. She might have transitioned since I've been gone. I don't know. And she and I have been doing deep work for about 6 months. And I'm always in this, we're always conversing with ourselves, right, internally about what's sharing, what's useful sharing, what's actually cultivating this relationship, this trustworthy relationship, and what's kind of overshare and what's creating a burden. And I finally just said, ugh, I trust myself. I trust that I am not going to give them my cell phone, you know, tell her things that aren't appropriate. And she and I have such a sweet relationship, and she goes through all kinds of chaos when in between visits. And I finally realized that I had this gorgeous heart that a friend had given me. And this heart has been on my medicine Buddha statue for years. And I have carried that heart around with me. And I'm kind of like attached. I really love it, right? And Spirit said, girl, you know what? She needs to have it. And I really had to think about it because I wanted to make sure I was giving her something of mine, right? So I had to kind of scan myself. And I really realized that it was glaring. It's not like it took a lot of, you know, contemplating me to see. We have a real relationship, she and I. And so I came with it one day and I said, you know, I would like you to have this because I want you to know when I'm not here, I'm here. And she says, I love you. And I say, I love you back because I trust myself. And she has this heart hanging from her lamp next to her bed. And in her delirium a week ago, she said to the volunteer, somebody really special gave that to me. I was sitting right there. So I just want to kind of offer trusting yourselves in that relationship and knowing that it's real relationship and that you probably aren't going to overstep the mark because you're probably really good at what you do and you know yourself. Trust that the love is permitted and that you can probably let go a little bit more. And they feel that. People feel that.
So as the professor up here, I'm going to say that this question points to the teachings of interrelatedness. Because we often think, oh, there's that person over there, and I'm over here, and they're going to give something, and I'm going to get something. But I think what Alistair and Joe are both talking about is a kind of humble curiosity and deep engagement with the mystery of this interrelated moment. That we are entering each moment not as selves that are somehow bumping up against one another, that we actually are this moment of interrelatedness. And if we approach that with the tenderness and respect that these two experienced chaplains are talking about, and that, as Joe points out, probably all of you are very familiar with, we discover the skillful means, we say in Buddhism. You know, there's wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. And so when we enter that tenderness and learn from it, the appropriate response, as we say, you know, one of the things about Zen teachings is, what is the whole of the Buddha Dharma? An appropriate response. Yeah. So I think we have time for one or two more questions. Yes, in the back.
I'm curious, within Buddhist healing principles, how you would sort of interrupt or And I feel like you, Joe, got to this when talking about your wife's best friend stuff.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah, I'm curious to hear more, because I find that that's like a very, that weighs on the hearts and minds of families and staff members, that someone might have a good or a bad death, and that kind of dualism.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And I think it's also a conversation. And then, and this is where our sort of attention as chaplains, I feel, comes in really importantly, because I feel like as chaplains and often social workers, but you know, chaplains are pretty, we have a really, we're special. I think we get to play a special role, which is like this really panoramic view of seeing what's happening. And so we can often take it out of the binary, good, bad. There's so much more. There's a middle way. But we can catch things like symptom management, right? If I'm the only person in the house from the medical team and someone's in pain, I'm probably not going to start quoting scripture, or I'm going to call the nurse and say, is it time for this person to have methadone, morphine, or whatever? So I think our level of attention really helps to hone in on, well, for one thing, what the person identifies as a good death. You know, just to use a black and white term, a good death. We use that language, right? And what they want. Some people are okay with dying in excruciating pain. And I've had those people, and it has been like I've been grinding my teeth at night. But that's what they want. And I think we kind of hone in on what are the aspects that are regarded as good. You know, is someone suffering existentially? Is someone suffering physically? You know? And I think that dying is really hard. Leaving the physical body is actually quite an epic process. You've probably all observed. It's not easy. And so often when I'm watching people, I'm thinking, well, what's really necessary for them to go through? You know, in terms of like agitation or irritation or get some medicine, you know? So I think we kind of work with the medical teams to kind of assess what's actually happening for this person. And are we checking our agendas about what we regard as good or bad and finding out who this person is, because they're going to die how they've lived as and who they are. Right? So where is the advocacy needed? Where is the step back needed? And where is the really direct communication needed to find out, are we doing everything we can to make sure this person leaves peacefully in the way that they need to? Does that tap on any of what you're saying? Yes.
It's beyond a kind of static dying on a ventilator.
Yes. Yes.
This is good, but that it's a dynamic. You described it as yes. A dynamic of the relationship.
Yes, and I think that as chaplains, we hold this recognition of that, right? And that's what we kind of bring and go from there. Uh-huh. Yeah.
When does it become okay for us to point out what we see in the big picture in those care conference moments where...
All the time. Okay, because you know what? Otherwise, if we don't say it, it's probably not going to get said, and nobody's... Well, in my line of work in hospice, it's different, but in a hospital, you're just going to get steamrolled. If you don't. So I say, you say it, even if your voice is shaking and you feel like it's going to piss somebody off, because it's all about what needs to happen and what is useful for and respectable for that person. So that's where we have to put on our big girls' britches and take up space. And that's where the role of chaplaincy becomes profound and transformational.
So I just want to point out it's past time, but I know there's one person who's been patiently asking, waiting to ask a question back there. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. So thank you all for being here. It's been a pleasure to share this time with you. And please go forth and multiply.